We left off last time with the close of the Abrahamic narrative, which is Abraham remains alive after this point, of course, but he will, of course, in a few chapters we're going to see his passing, but the narrative now moves to focus on Isaac. So in chapter 23, we hear about the death of Sarah. And then in chapter 24, Abraham seeks a wife for his son, and he sends out his chosen servant, probably Eleazar, that we've seen talked about earlier. This is a great example of how Abraham was treating his slaves. A lot of times we'll hear about slavery in Genesis and be like, oh, it's okay to have slaves. Maybe Alabama was okay, the whole thing. No! The slavery that we find in Genesis is different from the slavery that was going on in that hideous experiment in American history. Abraham was buying these people from the slave blocks, yeah, from Egypt and Haran, but they're becoming part of his people. What slave do you think some master in Alabama could have given a load of horses or a couple of wagons full of gold and said, travel to a far-off country and come back and bring a wife for my son? None. Because they are called servants. They're slaves because they were bought as slaves, but they are being treated as his own children. And this is an important thing to remember when we read Genesis. We're not simply reading some sort of camcorder of history. All the books of the Bible, including Genesis, were written by a particular author for a particular audience. And no matter what you want to, how you want to read that information, who's the author and who's the audience, there is no one on earth that will read the authorship of Genesis as any earlier than Moses. So let's start with that very early idea. Genesis, in some way, comes through Moses to us, which means that it must be written in a way that is intended for an audience at the time of Moses or later, depending on how you want to take it. So what that will do is help us understand when we read the book of Genesis, we're not just simply reading what we might call today history, just some run-of-the-mill, straight information. There is no such thing, by the way, right? Everyone tells history from a particular perspective. But we'll often hear that. Oh, just give me the straight, you know, facts. Give me the scientific history. Well, everyone chooses what they think is important to talk about. A newscaster has a limited amount of time. A historian with a PhD has a limited amount of paper in a particular book about a particular subject. So everyone has a bias. So what is the author's bias of the book of Genesis? His bias or his perspective is clearly something after the time of Genesis, right? The earliest you can pin it down would be Moses. So if we go with that early patristic idea, Moses has some sort of a hand in the formation of this book, then that means that this book is written in a way to catechize the Israelites coming out of Egypt, right? So that will help us in a number of ways as we read through this book. Here is a classic example. God has brought Israel out of Egypt. They were slaves. He's bought them off the slave block. That's a theme you get in Exodus and throughout a number of places in the Old Testament, that God purchased Israel as a bunch of slaves out of Egypt. Well, import that into the image here now, right? What has become of them? They've become his sons, right? His sons and daughters, his own children. All right. You know the story about the camels and the water and all of that. Also, you may know if you're interested in the themes in Genesis and Exodus, whenever they go to a well, that's where you're going to get a wedding. In chapter 25, Abraham took another wife. Her name was Keturah. Keturah, highlight that. And she bore a number of boys. The one you want to know about is Midian. You see Midian there? The Midianites. So this is critical to understand the interaction of Israel with the Midianites. They're both descendants of Abraham. So the Midianites and the Israelites are going to deal with each other differently than the Israelites might deal with, say, the Canaanites. All right, so Abraham's first wife was Sarai. She's now dead. Right? She took another, Sarah was her other name, but she has now passed on. And Abraham has this, takes on another wife, Keturah. And then, of course, with Sarai gone, Hagar shows up again. She comes back on the scene. And look what it says in verse 6. But the sons of the concubines of Abraham, now Abraham gave gifts to them, and he sent them off to the east country, eastward. So he now sends them away. So the Ishmaelites and the Midianites leave Palestine to go into the eastern desert together. And so the Midianites and the Ishmaelites are going to dwell as one people. We'll find there's two other passages, one in Genesis and one in the book of Judges, where we'll see that the names Ishmael and Midianite will be used interchangeably. Verse 7, these are the days of the years that Abraham's life, 175 years. Remember, you may hear sometimes someone says, oh, people can't live more than 120 years because God said so. That's not such a nonsense. That's not what the fathers of the church said. When, if you read Genesis chapter 6, it says the breath of the, in the life of man will be 120 years. That's a reference to until the flood comes. 120 years from until the flood comes. Not that this is some sort of internal, you know, rule that man can't live beyond 120 years. There's examples all over the place. Here's one of them. Abraham lived 175 years. You go to France or, you know, you'll find different places in which you have these people who live very, very long, over 120. All right, then we hear about the descendants of Ishmael, 12 tribes. Not of great importance here, but just to notice that that is the fulfillment of Genesis 17, when God promised that Ishmael would be the father of many nations as well, because he's also a son of Abraham. Chapter 25, verse 19, Isaac and Rebekah. We hear about pregnancy issues. She's barren first, but then Isaac prays. And when Isaac prays, instead of going after a handmaiden, there's a stark contrast between the Abrahamic narrative and the Isaac narrative here. Isaac will do everything that Abraham did, at least all the good parts, okay? But anything that you thought Abraham shouldn't have done, Isaac will not do as you watch the story. So there's the stories sound very similar, and yet if you watch them very carefully, who's doing what, Abraham versus Isaac, there's a significant difference here. Okay, so instead of going to take a concubine, he prays. And what happens? She's pregnant with twins. Okay? No need to take a concubine here. You see the difference there of Abraham and Isaac? All right. And then verse 24, when her days were delivered, were fulfilled, behold, there were twins. Verse 25, the first came forth red, and his body was hairy. So they called him Hairy, Esau. Afterward, his brother came forth, and his hand had taken hold of Hairy's heel. So his name was Healer, Yaakov, the guy who grabs the heel. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter and a man of the field, but Jacob, he liked to stay at home. Verse 29, once when Jacob was boiling pottage, Hairy came in from the field, and he was famished. And Hairy said to Jacob, or Slippery One, or Healer, the tripper, let me eat some of that red pottage, for I am famished. Therefore, his name was also called Red. So he's sometimes called Hairy, sometimes Red Hairy. Jacob, tripper, said, first sell me your birthright. Hairy said, what good is my birthright if I die? What's the name of that? What's a birthright? The birthright in this context is your material inheritance. When a firstborn son was expected to inherit two things from his father, his birthright, that was his material inheritance, and his spiritual inheritance, the blessing from his father, the laying on of hands. Okay, so then, the first one is what we're going to see Jacob steal first. Jacob steals the birthright here. Esau says, you know, who cares about, he doesn't care. He doesn't want the tents of his father. He doesn't live in a tent. He likes to live out in the wilderness and hunt game. So all he does all day long is go out there and hunt. He loves it. He's a wilderness guy. Okay. So he says, whatever, just give me some of those lentils. So Esau despised his birthright. So two things to notice here. First of all, when you think, well, Jacob, that wasn't really nice of him. Well, it wasn't. His elder brother came in and was hungry. He had the obligation to feed his brother. But instead, he played a little trick on him because he knew his brother wasn't all that bright. Right? Yeah, come on, give me the birthright. His brother didn't realize what he'd be losing. And look at what it says. He despised his birthright. So they're both culpable. Jacob should not have done this. But at the same time, Esau should not have been so foolish. Toss away his birthright for a bowl of lentils. Now, during Lent, and you're hungry, lentils aren't too, a bowl of lentils, not too bad. But this is pretty serious stuff here, okay? His birthright for a bowl of lentils. Chapter 26, we hear that there's a famine in the land, like in the time of Abraham. The author reminds you, when Abraham went to Egypt, what does Isaac do? He doesn't go to Egypt. He stays there. He lives in the land. He plants in the land, and he reaps a hundredfold, verse 12. We even hear, in case we miss the parallels, the story parallels for us even the life of Abraham down in Egypt. You have the Abimelech story with Isaac and Rebekah. All right, so then again, lots of other parallels with Abraham and Isaac. If this was a whole course on the Pentateuch, we'd spend time looking at these, but chapter 26, verse 34, notice that Esau has multiple wives. He's taking women from the Hittites, and not just one, but many. Polygamists. And what do we talk about? Polygamy and murder goes hand in hand, right? So what do you expect is going to happen next? Chapter 27 is going to be about Esau trying to kill Jacob. All right, chapter 27. When Isaac was old, his eyes were dim, so he could not see. He called Harry, his older son, and said to him, "My son," he said, "here I am." He said, "go give me a nice, you know, kill me a deer and make me a nice feast before I die. I'll bless you." "Okay, Dad." So he takes off. Verse 5, Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son, Harry. So she said, "Jacob, go," her favorite boy, "go get a kid goat, all right? And I'll fix it up the way your dad likes. I know how he likes to eat. And then I'll prepare it for him. And then he'll bless you instead of your older brother. We'll trick him," right? And does this bother you? I hope it does, right? Just like when Lot tried to give away his daughters. I hope that bothered you. Don't just say, "oh, well, I suppose hospitality for the guest is really important." What? These are his two daughters. Okay, and again, you won't understand the end of the story if you don't use your conscience. So you're nervous. Oh, this is not right, is it? Verse 8, "now therefore, my son, obey my word as I command you." Maybe even an allusion there to the Eden story, right, of Eve talking to Adam there. Obey the voice. But anyway, so Jacob says, "no, but Mom, what if he figures it out? And I'm a smooth man." Now, there's a play here in the Hebrew. Smooth can also mean deceptive. So I'm a smooth man. What if he figures out I'm not hairy and he curses me and said, "listen, don't worry, son. Upon me be your curse," verse 13. So it's not just Jacob's doing something wrong. Rebecca's doing something wrong. And so, well, how's this going to work out? Well, Rebecca's never going to see Jacob again after all this. Her favorite son's going to be gone. So she'll get what's coming to her. Jacob's going to get what's going to come to him, too. We're going to see, like, the rest of his life is going to be dealing with this problem. Rebecca gets off easy because at least she dies. Jacob has to live out the rest of his life with this. So they take the kid goat, they take the skins, they put them on his hands and on his neck so that he feels hairy. And then some of Esau's garments she puts upon her favorite son, Tripper. Verse 18. So he went to his father and said, "my father," and he said, "here I am, who are you, my son?" And Tripper said, "I am Harry, your brother, your father, your son, the firstborn." Is that a lie? Yeah, it's a whopper, okay? And his poor daddy's blind. "I've done as you told me. I've got your game. Now bless me." Verse 20. But Isaac said, "how is it that you have gotten so quickly, my son?" He answered, "because Yahweh, your God." What? whoa, something's wrong, right? Not my God, your God has helped me. Isaac said, wait a minute. So this is the second chance he had to admit to it. Isaac, wait a minute, come here. The voice is truer, but come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really hairy. So Jacob went near, and he felt him. He said, the voice is tripper, but the hands are hairy. Hey, you see what's going on here with the goat skin on? And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy, like his brother Harry's hands. So he blessed him. He said, are you really my son, Harry? He said, I am. And he said, bring it to me that I may eat of my son's game. So he's trying to trick him a little bit. He said, come here, let me smell you. So he smells him. Right? Sure, Esau didn't smell so great, right? He was out there always in the wilderness. So he smells, boy, this smells like Esau. Why? He's wearing Esau's clothes. He says, all right, it's got to be Esau. So he gives him the blessing. Verse 30, as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out, then Esau came. He said, arise, father. And he said, "What are you? Who are you? I'm your son, the firstborn, Harry. Well, wait a minute. Uh-oh. Well, who came in before and I blessed him? Uh-oh. I blessed the wrong boy, Harry. I blessed your younger brother. He tricked you. Your brother came with guile. And he has taken away your blessing, my son." Right? So if you had any question about whether Jacob's doing anything wrong here, it's quite clear, okay? If you have a numbed conscience to the whole thing, right? Isaac clearly says he came in and deceived his father. Okay? Remember, there's a commandment. Honor your father and mother. You remember that one? This might be one of those would be kind of, breaking that one slightly. Okay. So then, I say this because we read this stuff with blinders on. I say, oh, well, I guess that was okay because there was a prophecy that he would be ruler, and so Rebecca and Jacob, they're just making it work out a little faster, right? The end never justifies the means. Right? The end never justifies the means. God is in control. Look at David. Look at the difference of David. David had the opportunity to kill Saul 100 times. David could have killed Saul any time. David knew he was going to be the next king. David knew that Saul was going to die and that David would be the next king. And Saul's trying to kill David. And David has chance after chance to kill him. I will not. Even his soldiers come up and say, David, come on. He's in the cave. Go kill him. Yes, I will not. I will not. Right? He will not put forth his hand and take the anointed. And why? Because he's, leave this in the Lord's hands. This is not my job. God may have prophesied that I will be king after Saul, but I'm not going to take this in my hands to bring it about. Right? This is God's job, not my job. So the same thing here. All right, then look at verse 36. This is one of the funnier lines here, verse 36. Then Harry said, is he not rightly called tripper? For he has tripped me these two times. The verb there, supplanted in your text, is he not rightly called Jacob? For he has Jacobed me these two times. The word there, the verb, is that's the root, the same root. It's a verb built off the same root as the name Jacob. Right? He's tripped me, Jacob me, he's healed me. First he took away my birthright, now he's taking away my blessing. Dad, please! Okay, so there were two things he took. Most people conflate these in their mind. Two things that Jacob takes. The material blessing, the birthright to the land and all the wealth of his father. The second thing he takes here, much more important one, of course, is the blessing. All right. Now you say, well, looks like he got away all right there, didn't he? Verse 41, Esau decides to kill him. Okay? Try living in a few tents in a little, out in the middle of nowhere with a guy trying to kill you. So, not so good. He wants to kill him. We talked about this. Polygamy and murder go hand in hand in Genesis. And then second, Jacob is now going to have to flee from his father's presence, from the land promised to Abraham and from his mother. Okay? He's going to flee from from his parents, his father, his mother, his brother, his family. He's going to have to leave them and go live in a foreign land. Right? So does that sound good? No, this is not good for Israelites to remain in the land, the promised land. It's really, really bad. All right? They said, well, it's not so bad. He's going to go on vacation for a bit. Oh, this is not a vacation. Watch what happens. All right, so chapter 28, he takes off to go back to the land of his mother's relatives. Along the way, he takes a nap, goes to sleep at night. He puts his head on a little rock, smooth rock, and he has a dream. And in the dream, he looks up at the top of a ladder. He sees God, and he sees angels coming up and down on this ladder to this spot. So when he wakes up, he realizes, he says, this is the house of God, Beit El, house of God. And so he pours oil on that rock. He says, I'm going to return here someday. This is the house of God, a special place. Now, that, of course, will come up later on in John's gospel. We'll hear about this, right? John's gospel, Jesus will talk to Nathanael. He says, oh, you think this was amazing? I told you about the fig tree. Wait till you see the angels going up and down upon the Son of Man, right? Jesus is that rock, the anointed rock, the Christ. More about that in the New Testament story. Chapter 29, there's a well. You're probably going to hear wedding bells here, right? Chapter 29, Jacob sees Rachel, and he loves her. Verse 13, when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister, so he ran to meet him, embraced him. This is Laban. This is Rebekah's brother. So this is Jacob's uncle, right? When Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister, so he ran to meet him and embraced him. And Laban said, stay with me, but surely you are bone of my flesh. You shall not stay with me. I mean, you got to, let me give you something, right? So he says, tell me what will be your wages if you're going to stay here with us and work among us. Oh, that's easy, Laban. My uncle, give me Rachel as my wife. Oh, no problem. I got daughters to get rid of. That's great. So for 7 years, I will serve you. Verse 18, why seven? Random? Toss the dice? God's lucky number? Right? They're making a covenant. Right? They're making a deal. 7 years. He says, okay, fine, 7 years. So after 7 years, Jacob served 7 years. And then after the 7 years, verse 21, he said, my time is complete. Let me receive my wife. Verse 22, Laban gathered together all the men of the place to have a big feast, big wedding party. And then verse 22, look at this. But in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob. And he went into her. In the morning, he woke up. And behold, it was Leah. Uh-oh. Now, how could this happen? This is before Edison light bulbs, electricity. They say that, okay? They got little lamps, oil lamps in the tent. Just during the feast is all they got, a couple oil lamps. The feast would have gone on into the evening. They would have been drinking. And in the wedding ceremony, the woman would be completely veiled. She's wearing the wedding garments of her sister. She probably has the same stature of her sister, probably the similar voice to her sister, right? It's dark. Laban's, Jacob's had a few drinks. So, and again, she's veiled. The remnant of this, by the way, in the modern wedding service, you have a remnant of this in a couple places in modern society. In the modern wedding service, girls always want a veil with their wedding dress. They don't know why, but somehow there's supposed to be a veil, right? And the super traditional veil is the one that goes over the face. And then the less traditional is the one that hangs over the head, right? But, or sometimes they'll just throw the thing over. But wherever the case may be, every girl says, oh, I got to have a veil. Why? Why do they want a veil? Well, I don't know. That's what goes with the wedding dress. Well, it goes back to the ancient Judeo-Christian tradition. This predates Christianity. It goes back to the Jewish tradition. They would veil themselves from the moment they were betrothed, whenever they were out in public, and then from the wedding day forward, always outside, whenever they went out in public, a woman always had a veil covering her face in some way, something draping over her head as a sign, not like you see with the godless Muslims today with the little peepholes and stuff, it's a bunch of nonsense. But they would have some sort of a veil on their head as a sign that they were taken, they were married, a function like the wedding ring in that society. So so she's got some sort of a veil like that. The and then from there on out, they would have worn the veil. Today in the wedding service, they take the veil off afterwards and run away, you know, whatever they do. But the nun's veil today is a remnant of that. The nuns today wear a veil because they're married. In the first couple centuries of Christianity, they continued with this practice of married women wore a veil when they were out in public, which included church, which is where that you still today, sometimes in traditional churches, a woman will wear a veil when she goes into the church. Doesn't know why. I don't know. That's what you're supposed to do. Well, it goes back to an ancient tradition that the woman, when she went out in public, she dressed appropriately. She covered herself modestly, which included a veil, as a sign that she was married. She was taken. A girl that's not married, well, no veil and a little more revealing, right? She's available, right? She's so the young women who are these dedicated virgins and the widows, they looked like they were available in these Christian communities. So what the early church did is they told them, you got to put on a wedding veil as a sign that you're unavailable. We like putting a wedding ring on. Today, a lot of the nuns do that. They put a wedding ring on, right? It's kind of a similar parallel to the thing. So, oh, I'm not available. And then the, what else? That's enough. Tons of other parallels. But, okay. Chapter 29, look what happens here. I love this line here. Laban answers. He says, what have you done to me? Laban said, this is verse 26. It is not done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. The younger before the firstborn, right? If you had a bunch of girls, you'd marry them off according to age, the oldest first. Because you've got to get these girls married off while they're still, you know, of marital age. So he says, look, she's the elder. That's what we do in our country. I don't know what you do in your country. You can hear the echo, right? Look at the parallels here. You've got the darkness of a tent, right? You've got two tents. You have Isaac's tent, the father, who's being deceived by Jacob, the younger. Here you've got Laban, the father-in-law, deceiving Jacob for the sake of the elder, the firstborn. Jacob wore the clothes of his older brother to deceive his father. Here the father gives the clothes of the younger to the elder to deceive Jacob. The whole thing goes on and on. It's hilarious. This is not the end of the story for poor Jacob. He's going to haunt him the rest of his life. All right. So then he serves, he completes the week, the octave, this is a seven-day wedding feast. He completes this, and then he gets Rachel as well. So now he has two wives. He said, oh, nice. Move to Utah. I'm sure it'll be a happy family. Look what happens. Verse 31. When the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Maybe Utah won't work out so well. All right, so you find whenever you look at polygamy in Genesis, you will never find polygamy in a good light. The typically, you're going to find it among the pagans in the book. And when you find it among the patriarchs, it's always shown immediately to be a problem. Genesis began this way. Adam and Eve. It wasn't Adam, Eve, and Susie, Janet, Lori, whatever. No. Man and woman. So Jesus quotes this in Matthew's gospel. He created man and woman. That's it. Not man, woman, and woman, and woman. Verse 32. Leah conceived. Now, you don't need to memorize all these names. I can't keep track of half of myself. What's important for you is to remember a few of them. Six of them, in fact. Well, seven of them. The first four children that are born for Jacob come from Leah. They are Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. You should remember that. Reuben is the firstborn. Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Remember that, right? Now you can add one more onto that just for the next story, and that is Dinah. Dinah is a daughter born of Leah. You know she comes from Leah to understand the next story. So those are the five that you need to remember, the five kids that come from Leah. The rest don't worry about. and the concubines you need to worry about. You do need to remember also, as we'll find out, that that Rachel will bear two children, Joseph and Benjamin. Joseph and Benjamin. If you remember those sons, you got everything down. Okay, everything else is almost irrelevant as far as the nation. Okay. We're going to hear, as we read through the rest of Genesis, you hear about Jacob and Laban striving together about, you know, whether Jacob's going to get his pay and the proper amount of sheep and stuff to support his family. Finally, Jacob decides to go home. He picks up, takes his two daughters and the kids born, and heads back to Palestine. This is in chapter 31. Laban pursues him. Laban pursues him. We're told about a funny incident, and that is that Rachel takes the household gods. The household gods. Why would she want these? What are these? They're some little figurine statues of local pagan gods, particular gods that were worshipped by their particular family. These might be local pagan gods of various kinds, and they might be some sort of ancestor worship as well. Typically, the gods were, almost all of these gods in the ancient world, had something to do with life and fertility. Right? Rachel has only had one boy. So she's probably looking for some sort of divine assistance from the pagan deities. Whatever the case may be, Laban finally comes upon them, overtakes them, and accuses Jacob of stealing the household gods and stealing his daughters and his grandkids. Well, so then Jacob says, look, I didn't take anyone. I didn't steal anyone. You were giving me a hard time, so I decided to go home. But as far as the household gods, whoever has them, they shall be dead. Right? We'll kill them. Okay? Jacob says, I didn't steal any household gods, you fool. Well, Laban searches throughout the tents, and he comes upon Rachel's tent. And Rachel hides the gods under the camel saddle, which was in the tent, and sits upon the saddle and says, oh, father, don't let me arise. I can't arise. I'm sorry in your presence because it is the way of a woman with me. Oh, okay. So Laban backs out of the tent, right? The little idols are hidden underneath the saddle. Even there, again, if you read these stories really carefully, you say, well, that wasn't really right, was it? No, it wasn't right. She's going to die the next time she gives birth, right? She's using her fertility as a sign to hide these pagan gods. She's going to die giving birth to her next boy. Now, I don't know if that was intended by the author that way, but it seems like it's the kind of the reaping what you sow here, but who knows? All right. Chapter 31, we hear about a covenant between Laban and Jacob that they won't try and kill each other. The only thing you might want to note here is the phrase, between you and me. This is a phrase, whenever you get a covenantal context, and the fact that they have a meal. Meal, the phrase between you and me, and the number 7. Those three things are going to usually indicate to you you're in a covenant. You're either going to see one of them, or two of them, or all three of them sometimes. Not of great importance, this covenant here, but you want to look at these stories so you can pick up on these things. So later on, you hear something like between you and me. Oh. Or you hear about a meal. Wait a minute, what's going on? Or you hear the number 7. Are we dealing with a covenant? Chapter 32 and 33, we hear about the return of Jacob back to Palestine. We hear about him wrestling with an angel as he enters in. This is where he gets the name Israel, he who wrestles with God. As he enters back into the land, his hip is put out of joint, so he has a limp for the rest of his life. Again, this guy does not return without scratches, okay, and scars from what's happened. He doesn't come back in easy. He may have come back with wealth and family, but he has not come back having lost nothing. He's lost all these years of his life away from the promised land. He's lost all those years of his life with his father. He never saw his mother again, and now he's going to limp for the rest of his life. But things are not perfect for Jacob. Chapter 34, we have this story about Dinah. The only reason this is important for us is to understand what happens to Simeon Levi. Dinah gets raped by a man named Shechem. And Shechem falls in love with her and wants her for his wife. Now, this is a very strange story for modern society, but this is how things went back then. Okay? So Shechem asks his father to go to Jacob and make a deal so that he can have Dinah as his wife. Jacob says, you know, we cannot because, you know, we're circumcised and you guys are not circumcised. If you get circumcised, we can do such a thing. Come on. So they circumcise everybody in the town. All the inhabitants of the town are circumcised so that they can intermarry with this new tribe that's moved into the region. Verse 25, on the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, went and killed everybody in the town. And they took Dinah back home. They even killed the animals. So Simeon and Levi, why would Simeon and Levi do this? Because Reuben doesn't do it because he's the firstborn son. He's supposed to do what dad says. So he doesn't do this. But Simeon and Levi, along with Reuben and Judah, these guys are the brothers of Dinah. So they decide to attack. Chapter 35, God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there and make there an altar to the God who appeared to you. So he says, he tells the people with him, put away the foreign gods, guys. We're getting monotheists here. All right. This is a constant problem for the people of Israel as they come out of Egypt. It's a constant problem for the people of Israel, God's people throughout history, right? As it's been said many times, God brought Israel out of Egypt with a strong right hand, but it took the rest of salvation history to get Egypt out of Israel, right? The paganism, the polytheism is still in their heart. Okay, then in chapter 35, verse 16, we hear about the birth of Benjamin. When they're a distance from Ephrath, that is Bethlehem, this is that other name for Bethlehem, between Bethel and Bethlehem on the way, she gives birth to Benjamin, this boy, who she calls first Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow. But Jacob renames him, son of my right hand. He doesn't like that, son of my sorrow. That's not a very good name for the kid, right? Now, why son of my right hand? Well, these are the boys, Joseph and Benjamin. These are the boys of his, these are the children of his favorite wife, Rachel, right? The one he intended. All right. Chapter 35, verse 22. Another little detail you got to know to understand the rest of the book. While Israel dwelt in that land, Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. So, two important details we've gathered from these chapters here. Simeon and Levi went and did something they weren't supposed to do. And Jacob chastised them for it. They were not, they could have killed us. What are you doing? You could have started World War III, right? Well, proto-World War I in that case. All right, so then, and then now, Reuben goes and lays with his father's concubine. Not good. Both of these things are going to come back to haunt them at the end of the book. Now, the sons of Jacob were 12. And then you get the listing of them, right? Here they are in case you couldn't keep track of them. But again, remember, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, they come from Leah. Then remember that Joseph and Benjamin come from Rachel. The rest don't really matter too much for them. And then Isaac died, and they buried him. Chapter 36 tells us about the descendancy of Esau. The only thing you might want to note here is in verse 33, you hear about a guy named Jobab. Verse 33 and 34, Jobab. Okay, now you might not recognize that, but let me slow it down. Jobab, or Father Job. According to the Jewish tradition, this is Job, the guy we're going to hear about in the book of Job later on. In fact, if you look at the story of Job, it fits in right in line with the theology of about this era of Israel's history. Father Job. Chapter 37. Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. This is the history of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. Here we hear about Joseph being set apart from the rest of them, right? They're off shepherding. Joseph is set apart. They go off. He goes, and Dad says, hey, go check on your brothers, see how they're doing. They come back to me. Joseph is not out there shepherding. He has a robe with long sleeves, right? Long sleeves. Now, if I had to wash the dishes right now, what would I do? Pull these sleeves up, right? If I had to go do some work, right, I pull my sleeves up, right? In the ancient world, someone who was a servant had short sleeves, or no shirt at all, short sleeves and short leggings or a short skirt. It was the wealthy, the wealthy, the aristocracy, the kings with the long flowing garments. Today, none of this is totally different. It's cold, so we wear long garments. It's short. It's summer, well, we wear short garments. But back then, they were functional in this way. If you had to go out and work in the field, or you're a soldier, you're some sort of a servant, you had short garments. If you were wealthy, you didn't work for a living, you weren't a soldier, you had long flowing garments. Think of the extreme of this, of like the royal train, right, flowing from behind someone. No way that's not going to work out in the field as you're harvesting barley. This is also where you hear the Joseph's coat of many colors. This is where it comes from. Now, in the Hebrew, it says the garment was to the palms. Okay, to the palms. This is in the Hebrew. And palms means not only hands, but the bottoms of the feet in Hebrew. So it's a long flowing garment to his feet and to his hands. But in the Greek, it says a garment with varying threads. Varying threads. Which then comes into the Latin and then eventually into the King James Bible as many colors. So then before you know it, you have Joseph's coat, technicolor, coat of many colors. So it may have had multiple colors, but that's not the point of the story. That is not what's the point. The point is the long flowing garment. Many threads probably was the original sense of it in the Greek. The idea is it had lots of material to it. Chapter 37, verse 5, Joseph had dreams, two dreams. Both dreams show that he's going to have some sort of future preeminence over his brothers. While this does not make them happy, verse 12, his brothers were out pasturing their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, go and check on your brothers, see how they are, and then you come back to me some, right? He's not working with the other brothers. When they see him coming, they decide to kill him. Reuben at first tries to save him by putting him into the well. In the end, Judah is the one that we're going to see saves him. And this is the first turning point between Reuben and Judah. Reuben has lost his authority with his father. And then Simeon and Levi, of course, lost their authority. Reuben's going to try to get back an authority with his dad. He regained his firstborn position, but he never will. Judah will have that. Judah is the fourthborn from Leah, but he's going to end up as the firstborn, in a sense, with that honor. All right, you know the story. They eventually sell him off into Egypt. Here's a great example of something we just saw earlier today. We saw how the Ishmaelites and the Midianites dwelt together. If you read the story, who are the people who are buying and selling Joseph? It's Midianites, but it's Ishmaelites. No, it's Midianites. No, it's Ishmaelites. No, back and forth. Why? Because these people dwell together and their words are used interchangeably. We saw this already back in chapter 25, verse 2. They dwell together, verse 2 and verses 2 through 6. All right. Chapter 38, funny story about Judah and his sons, and that'll be important when we get into the genealogy later on. Chapter 39, Joseph is sold into Egypt. But when he's there, he becomes the overseer of the man's house that purchases him off the slave block. He becomes the overseer. Notice this. He continues this theme of being the one who is in charge. He was in charge of his brothers. Now he's in charge of the household of Potiphar. After being wrongly accused of things, he gets sent off to prison. Verse 21 and following, in prison, Joseph becomes the overseer of the whole prison. And it's in chapter 40 that we hear, while he's in prison, he interprets two dreams, the dream of the baker and the dream of the butler. Now, baker, don't think of a guy with a donut shop. This is the baker is the cook. This is the guy that makes food for Pharaoh. And then butler, depending on what your translation has there, is cupbearer. The old word, English word, butler, was not just a guy who opened your door. He was your head servant. He was the guy that brought you your glass of wine, your butler. And so this is the butler and the cook. This is the guy who brings Joseph his food and the guy who brings Pharaoh and who brings Pharaoh his drink. Well, as you read the story, the baker's dream doesn't turn out so well for him. He loses his head. But the butler is returned. He becomes the cupbearer again for Pharaoh, chapter 41. While he's in returned to stand before Pharaoh in chapter 41, Pharaoh has dreams, two of them. Notice the doubling of dreams, right? The doubling of Joseph's dreams, the two dreams of the two guys in prison, and now the dreams here of Pharaoh. What are the dreams? In one dream, he sees seven fat cows coming out of the Nile. Then seven skinny cows consume them. Then he sees seven fat, plump ears of barley. Then seven skinny little ears of barley. Eat it up. Some translations have corn here. Perfectly fine in Old English, but very confusing for an American translation, right? Corn, the white, the yellow stuff, the big thing, that's an American native, all right? And it's called corn in Old English because corn is the term for grain, okay? So there's no, a lot, it's my kid's children's Bible, drives me nuts. The picture here of the dream of Pharaoh, they actually got, you know, Kansas corn growing. But this is wheat or barley. This is a grain. Okay, so then in chapter 41, when Pharaoh can't figure out the meaning of these dreams, eventually, because of the butler, Joseph is brought before him. And Joseph hears the dreams and he interprets them. He says, this is simple. And the fact there's two dreams means it's true. Here's what the situation is, Pharaoh. There will be 7 years of plenty. These are the seven fat cows, the 7 ears of grain. But then there will be 7 years of famine so severe that will follow. They will consume all of the produce and all of the stores of the 7 years that were before, so as if they had never existed. Oh, wow, that's pretty good. What do we do? He says, well, let me give you some more advice. Pharaoh should probably find someone who's really, really smart, who's standing before him possibly, who can maybe interpret dreams, and might be a good economist, Pharaoh. Find someone who's really, really smart, the smartest man that you've ever seen, who can interpret things, the future and things, and might know something about this, to oversee Egypt for you, to make sure everything's okay for those 7 years of famine. Pharaoh takes the bait. Who can we find more wise than this man? And so Joseph becomes the, verse 40, overseer of all of Egypt. Overseer of all of Egypt. Now, what's important for you here, for a lot of passages in the rest of the Old Testament, is a little verse. Verse 45. Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaph. Penath Paneah, that doesn't matter anything, but he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On. So Joseph marries the daughter of a pagan priest. And this is a big deal for the rest of the Old Testament. This is going to cause big problems for Joseph's descendants, and we'll see. Joseph's descendants are half Egyptian. And not only half Egyptian, but pagan Egyptian. Priestly caste. Big deal. We'll see this come up in a number of places in the Old Testament later on. And if you didn't know that, then those passages wouldn't make so much sense. We hear about Joseph, of course, caring for Egypt, the 7 years of plenty, the 7 years of famine. We hear about him having two boys, Manasseh and Ephraim. Notice the order, Manasseh and then Ephraim. That'll be important. And with the 7 years of famine, Joseph, of course, had stored up enough of them as well in Egypt. However, in chapter 42, things weren't so good in Palestine. In Palestine, the famine was there as well. The famine hit this entire region. Not enough rain or whatever, who knows what. And so, in chapter 42, Jacob says to his sons, "Boys, get down to Egypt. I've heard there's grain down there." Now, he has no idea what happened to Joseph, right? He doesn't know that Joseph's down there. He doesn't know what's going on. His other sons had deceived him. His own sons had deceived him using the garments of his favorite boy, right? Hear the echo, right, from what he had done to his father? It's the same thing. It goes on and on like this. Right, when they took the blood of Joseph's the blood put on Joseph's garments and pretended he was dead. All right, chapter 42, they eventually go down into Egypt, and we hear about a number of trips down there, back and forth. As they go back and forth, Joseph seems to be acting very strangely. He says he wants to keep some of them there. He keeps Simeon there. Eventually he keeps Benjamin there. What's he doing? He's acting very strange, hiding things in the bag, hiding the money in there. It's bizarre. Unless you realize that this is a boy who was thrown into a pit by his brothers and sold into slavery. And he wants to see his dad. And he wants to see Benjamin, his younger brother. Right? He wants to see his younger brother's blood brother, the one from his same mother. So that's what's going on here about all these little tricks he's pulling with the money and who's staying there and who he wants to see. "Please, I want to see your youngest brother, Benjamin." That's his little brother, Benjamin, he wants to see. And then you also see another thing going on here. Reuben tries to take charge with his dad. Says, "Dad, don't worry. Let me take Benjamin down there. I'll take care of everything. If I don't come back with Benjamin, you can kill my boys for me." Okay? What? This Reuben is not a guy who's trustworthy. But Judah instead says, "Dad, we can't go to Egypt unless we take Benjamin with us. And I promise you, Dad, if Benjamin doesn't come back, I will be guilty. Hold me accountable." So he's going to be willing to give up all of his rights that he already now has, his firstborn son. Well, Jacob sees that as, okay, this guy's trustworthy. So Judah is able to take Benjamin down there, right? When finally Joseph just can't take it anymore. So this is in chapter 45, verse 4. Chapter 45, verse 4. Joseph finally reveals himself to his brothers. And look what he says here. Verse 5. "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still yet 5 years in which there will be famine. And God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant on the earth to keep me alive. So it was not you who sent me," verse 8, "but God." Well, here's a guy who's got his good grasp on history and reality, huh? Says, "Look, boys, look, my brothers. Yeah, what you did was evil. Your intentions were evil. And yet God has brought about a greater good." It's not simply he's balanced the scales here, but your evil has been surpassed by God's goodness. He has brought about from your iniquity a great thing, a blessing, even upon you. And so go get Dad and bring him down here. I want to see him. So they're going to bring now, the Israelites will all come down, their families, along with old Dad, Jacob. They're all going to go down into Egypt. But this is a wonderful lesson to learn here. This is a good spot let me see if we can finish this. Maybe we finish this tonight. Well, maybe we can finish tonight. You see this lesson that when in our lives we can look back and say, I shouldn't have done that. Or I wish I hadn't done it that way. Well, that's history. It's over. God can bring good out of it. God can bring good out of that. Okay? Thank God he can bring good out of it. Right? So we can look back into our lives and look at our failures and realize that even though they are failures, oh, absolutely, you're culpable. We've done it. We've made mistakes. And yet we can have confidence that God can bring a great good out of it. Look at the image of the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. Right? Thank you, Jesus. All right, so then, now, in chapter 47 and following, we hear about the Israelites eventually. They go down into Egypt. In chapter 48, we hear about that Jacob is getting old and he's about to die. They've been in Egypt for a while now. Jacob's getting old, he's about to die. He says to Joseph, come, boy, bring me your two sons. Now, he blessed them before I die, right? Jacob's the firstborn son of his favorite wife. And he's trying to make sure that his firstborn son from the first wife he intended to marry ends up getting the double portion, which is the material wealth, right? In the old system, a firstborn son would get either everything or they would divide up the amount of inheritance that the father had to give plus one. Number of boys plus one, and then the eldest son, we get a double portion. So he says, bring your two boys here. Let me bless them. And so he brings the two boys, and he blesses them, and look what happens. He refers to them. He keeps referring to them as Ephraim and Manasseh, not Manasseh and Ephraim. He's flipping the names around already. Then he flips the names around with his hands, right? He blesses Ephraim with his right hand, the younger, and Manasseh, the elder, with his left hand. So the primary blessing is given to Ephraim. So what Joseph just did, he adopted Ephraim and Manasseh. He says they will inherit, verse 5, they will inherit among their uncles. He just adopted these two boys of Joseph as his own sons, which just made Joseph a double portion. Forced the issue. Joseph now got a double portion. This is a material blessing. Right? Remember that? We talked about the material blessings. But Judah is going to get the spiritual blessing, right? Remember the two types of blessings are going to come here? So in chapter 49, we hear about the sons of Joseph, of Israel, brought before him, before he dies. And look what happens to Reuben. Reuben, you're my firstborn, but I know what you did. Skips over him. Verse 5, Simeon and Levi, you should have killed those guys in Shechem. With Shechem there, that was not what I gave you permission to do. He skips over them. And then look at verse 8. Judah, your brothers will praise you. So Judah gets the firstborn blessing, the spiritual blessing here. And he look at verse 9. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, who is gone, he stooped. And look what he says in verse 10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from his feet. That means after Joseph's, after Israel's dead, after Jacob dies, Judah is in charge. He's in charge. He gets the firstborn role in a certain sense. Now, it may be that Joseph, by splitting up to his sons and adopting the grandsons, the sons gets the material blessing. He gets an extra portion. Judah gets this special blessing, which in the end will be the most important, as we'll see in the rest of the Old Testament. But both of these issues, we're going to find that what just happened here with Ephraim and what just happened with Judah, you've got to understand these to understand what's going to happen later on in the times and the periods of the kings even, and the times of the prophets, and in the New Testament, with the woman at the well, the Samaritans, and the conversion verse in Acts, it's all based on what just happened. All right, more on that in another study. Okay, so in chapter 49, we hear about the death of Leah, the death of Leah. And guess who gets buried? I'm sorry, the death of Israel. And where does he get buried? He gets buried with Leah. So in the end, Leah, though mistreated and not loved as much as Rachel, she was technically his first wife. So he ends up being buried with Leah, the proper wife, in the end. God, in the end, is the author of history, right? Chapter 50. Chapter 50, we hear about the embalmment and the funeral ceremony, et cetera, et cetera. What's important for you is the last few verses here. In verse 18, when Jacob was dead, Joseph's brothers figured that Joseph's going to kill him. So they all gather to Joseph and bow down and they ask for forgiveness. And Joseph says, look at this again, verse 19. We just saw this before. Look at chapter 50, verse 19. Fear not, for am I in the place of God, ready to take your life? As for you, you meant evil against me. But God meant it for good, to bring about that, to bring it about that many people should pick up lives. So fear not. So again, look at this beautiful lesson here of what's happened. And look at Joseph, the prophet. Joseph understanding God's will. Discernment. That's what prophecy is in the Bible. A lot of times people think of prophecy in a pagan way. It's a foretelling of the future. It's not what it is. In the Old Testament, we find prophets telling about the future. But that's not what that's not their primary purpose in doing that. They're talking about the present situation, and you've got to make a decision that is going to affect what happens in the future. Are you going to repent or not repent? If you repent, then God will have mercy on you. If you don't repent, then God's going to kill you. Right? It's basically, so there's that future element in the prophets. That's not what they're doing. They're the mouthpiece of God. And this is what we hear about the gift in the New Testament, the gift of prophecy, the gift of prophecy from the Holy Spirit. It's not the gift of being able to foretell the future so much as the ability to speak the word of God. How many times have you been sitting in a pew in church on Sunday? Well, you're not supposed to be because those are invented by the Protestants. You know that. It's pews. But how many times have you been sitting in one of those Protestant benches, and you hear in the homily God speaking to you. And so you think the priest is talking directly to you about something you're dealing with in your life. And it's as if, it's literally like he's speaking right to you. You look around and think, does anyone else hear this? Well, yeah, other people are hearing other things in their own way. God's speaking to them through those same words, and the priest has no idea what's going on, right? So the same thing happens with when you hear scriptures, when you read the Bible, when you hear, especially in the liturgy, you hear the epistle or gospel read, a lot of times that gift of prophecy comes forth. All right, so Joseph, the great prophet, you meant this for evil, but God intended for good. And so we find here in Genesis a wonderful lesson to close with and meditate on this week. We can look back in our life, how we've lived. I don't know about you, but I can look at a lot of things in my past I wish I had done differently. But I have to, in the end, accept that that's the past. And God's the author of history. And even though God may have wanted me, preferred me to do something else than I did, he can work with that and bring about a greater good out of it, even out of my mistakes. Even out of my mistakes. All right, so let us glorify Jesus Christ, not only in the present moment and the future, but in what good he has brought out of our past with his eternal Father and his all-holy good life and spirit, both now and ever into ages and ages.